power projections. I'm very interested in gauge theoretic differential geometries, relationships to physics, and more importantly, bridging the gap to other fields outside of that. I'm currently focused on thinking about risk in markets and managing risk effectively and thinking about it from a creative standpoint, hopefully. So the title of the talk, Sheldon Glashow Owes Me a Dollar and 17 Years of Interest, What Happens Where the Endless Frontier Meets the Efficient Frontier, presupposes the endless frontier and the efficient frontier. So the endless frontier, of course, is a nod, the great sort of piece of parchment that supposedly sets out the contract in the United States between the universities and the federal government for the funding of science. A different Bush was the force behind it. And the efficient frontier is what's depicted here, which is a sort of idealized picture of the relationship between risk and return. And the idea being that the portfolios that one could select in general live in the interior of this funny shape, and that people of good character can argue about where they should live on the efficient frontier, how much risk and how much for how much return they're willing to trade off, but they should never seek to live in the interior because there's no point. And the Black Swan is a nod to Nassim Taleb and his attempt to popularize the concept that we pay far too much attention to the things for which we have data and not enough attention to those freak situations which often form pivot points for the world. And if we could only figure out something about them, even a small amount of knowledge about those unique objects might be much more interesting than a tremendous amount of knowledge about the generic situation. So I should just warn you guys, I redid the talk last night because I realized that I was assuming some things that I probably shouldn't have assumed, and it's possible that there will be some disjointedness. But here were some alternate titles. Oh, I promised myself I was going to do one thing before I even got started, and I've broken the rule. Now, so do I have the Ginsburg finger? Oh. My mojo, yeah. I'm melting. So what I've learned from being forced to code a tremendous amount recently is that I should wrap everything in a giant try clause. So there'll be some provocative statements. And I would like to apologize to begin with I don't get much of a chance to address meetings like this, and so it's worth trying to go a little bit heavy on man bites dog rather than doing the dog bites man routine. So from shut up and calculate to shut up and trade, shut up and calculate is, of course, sort of the cry of the Los Alamos physicists and the change in philosophical orientation that David Kaiser talked about. Shut up and trade is the idea that we can try to restrict the interaction between players in the marketplace of ideas and say you really need to confine yourself to things that represent risk-taking in the markets. So from one side of the fence, you have the establishment position, which is, if this is the marketplace of ideas, why can't I short you, your theory, and the horse you rode in on? What happens when I'm confronted with a new maverick who has some crazy idea, and I know enough about the idea to know that I've tried it, my students have tried it, it's not even that great of an idea to begin with, it's probably going to fail. I have knowledge. Why is it that I cannot use this knowledge? So in finance, we would talk about that knowledge as a view, your perception that you have knowledge. The key question is, what is your trade expression? Well, if there aren't instruments in that market, you've got a real problem. So you can't express your view in the market efficiently. The other side of it is the maverick's perspective. Go long, go short, or get out of my way. Lead, follow, or get out of the way is what that's patterned on. And the key point is that the mavericks frequently believe that they are being suppressed. They are being held back. And the idea of confining the established forces that be to types of speech that don't allow suppression but force the taking of risk and are non-destructive to the ideas is very, very appealing. So one of the hopes is to get agreement between these two groups. They have something to gain from moving towards the efficient frontier from an interior point. The title I'm really glad I didn't go with is, if my theory is so obviously and objectively wrong, why don't you quantify that by writing me a low implied volatility, deep out of the money barrier option for $15,000 premium with a 10-year tenor and future citations in the top 20 leading journals secured by your home, your summer home, your furniture, and your IRA. I think that one of the things that's very interesting as we see the LHC come online is we see articles about wagers. And we've been waiting for these wagers. We knew they were coming. One of the interesting things about these wagers is that they are more concentrated in the even money arena than they are concentrated in the wings, where finance tells us we should be very interested in options that attempt to find low probability events and profit from them. So one of my frequent accusations of my friend Lee is that the Perimeter Institute is forming his fund-of-funds structure. He's a manager in the fund-of-funds. He runs a long-vol portfolio, which he attempts to keep diversified by taking individuals with very unique perspectives. And he himself runs ideas instead of money inside of that long-vol portfolio he's attempting to keep diversified. The neat thing about Lee and his detractors is it's like the terrorism idea. Lee only has to be right once, right? The other guys have to be right all the time. And the only problem with that is that eventually Lee is going to bleed. He's going to have that long volatility problem that he's paying away premium. And the question is, how many times can he say, you know, this guy Garrett Lisi, he's got a great idea. I'm really, really encouraged before the community starts to cause him to bleed more than he can afford. The famous, I guess, line due to Keynes, I'm not going to get it exactly, but the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent is a big problem. Even if the idea works, it's not clear that any individual has the staying power to capitalize on the ultimate expected value. So the first problem with black swan science, and one way of getting out of my talk really, really quickly, is there anything to be said at all? Normally, a lot of these talks proceed from the perspective that they've got access to something like a data set, and they're going to look at citations or downloads or whatever. So they've got these really large ends, and from that, they're going to be able to come up with meaningful conclusions. So I want to begin with something that I learned from Ralph Gomery at the Sloan Foundation, which was sort of an eye-opener to me. I was talking about the importance of investing in high-risk research, and he says, you know, Eric, you're absolutely right, but you're saying it wrong. He says, what you don't understand is how much high-risk research only seeks to get mediocre results from the outset. And that's clearly not efficient. I don't want to invest in high-risk research unless it's really going to have a payoff that warrants it, because there's plenty of medium-risk research which goes after the same middle-of-the-road results. So I think it's really important that we somehow understand amongst ourselves that when we say high-risk, we mean only high-risk, high-return, and not risk-taking for the sake of embracing the human spirit. What we need is risk management in science. We need, at some level, a language akin to finance where, instead of struggling to convince your colleagues that there's a concept, you can refer to a word or a phrase so that, at some level, this becomes part of the vocabulary of how we control risk in the field. And it's startling how many of the concepts, I feel much more comfortable now in finance, not because I like the subject matter better necessarily, but because the concepts of risk that were so important to me when I was doing science have broad acceptance. You don't spend a lot of time arguing over whether or not certain kinds of strategies can or should work. Almost all effort in science policy is historically devoted to large N, particularly manpower theory, citation patterns, patents. And one of the things about large N is it builds in a measure of implicit risk management by allowing for diversification. And because it's built in implicitly, people find that kind of comfort without necessarily even being able to identify why they have that kind of comfort. But the purpose of my remarks is that I want to stimulate interest in find out. I'm probably only looking to talk to a couple of people in this room or anybody who might be watching the video, which is that I want to go after founder effects, things that are very hard to think about because they're low probabilities of success, high numbers of failures, and I want to stimulate the concept that maybe we can actually build up a theory of the black swan hatchery, right? Some place that is particularly good at recognizing early stage individuals and helping them across the adaptive valley. So adaptive valley is an important concept. If you think about it formally, you don't really understand what it feels like to go into one, and very few people come out of it. So the idea is here you make sense. As I was saying the other night, I feel like Garrett is going through his triple helix period. It's where you've got the phosphates on the inside, you've got the nucleotides sticking out, you've got the wrong number of these things, and you call in your colleagues and say, nailed it, right? Well, you don't have it, and you are absolutely fair game for everybody who knows more about the situation than you do. You might, for example, what? What is that?
Including financial guys.
Okay.
But somehow I managed to like you anyway. So.
Another example is predicting the proton as the antiparticle for the electron, because you happen to have some positively charged object and you don't have the guts to predict the positron because at some level that's too cognitively dissonant, right? You might propose the Ricci tensor without subtracting off some multiple of the metric in a gravity theory and publish it. Now somehow, this process of publishing wrong stuff is much more associated with an older time and more successful human beings who actually wind up on dorm room posters in college dormitories. Why is that? We have become very, very risk averse. We are sort of curating this museum culture where the idea is where people are allowed to contribute, but they are not allowed to detract. We have lots of powerful results. The key problem with going through an adaptive valley is that this is currently a very crazy-making process. You don't have the ability to say, yeah, I know I'm violating this principle or that law, but I have this alternate compass. Everybody else who's gone into this adaptive valley looked at the collection of facts, and I have a different filter, and I think that this is a guide, and I will be able to pay these things back on my way out to a higher level. So the question, in some sense, isn't who's brave enough to go into an adaptive valley. That's not very interesting. The question is, who has an interesting compass, which is an alternate compass, and what might it do to get up the other side? So I'm focused also on the bright side of increasing income inequality. There's a lot of moping about income inequality, and in Manhattan, I live around a lot of it. It's sort of tough to take, but one of the great things about it is that there's a huge number of high net worth individuals who've made their money managing risk, who have a very scientific orientation, whether they've been in industry or something closer to academics, you know, like biotech, what have you, who are very interested. I think when you get up into 8-9 figures, you start to have an immortality budget. And you think about, you know, should I endow buildings or schools or whatnot? And I believe that the sciences, in some sense, have the best undiscovered value in the immortality market. The only problem is that we don't currently have a Nobel Prize for backers. And I would like to nominate Marcel Grossman and his father as the first recipient, if this ever gets going, because we need to keep the names not only of the people who did most of the work, but the fact is that there's usually some early stage individuals who play the role of venture capitalists or private equity or what have you, who see these things early. And in finance, this is one of the best rewarded endeavors. If you're really, really intelligent, going into a highly developed market where things are highly efficient, it's very hard to make money. There are a few very skilled individuals who are good at that. But one of the best returns on intelligence is to go into early immature markets where you listen to a lot of stories. There aren't metrics. You don't have a tremendous amount of data. And you have to put together the pieces at a more human level, right? So I want to talk about something that really excites me. I mean, you guys are doing quantum physics, and we've just turned on the LHC. But think about luggage, right? Why is luggage so interesting? To me, luggage is interesting because it was only yesterday that all luggage sucked, right? I mean, it was terrible. And we didn't even know how bad it was. So every great mind you can think of before 1989 carried around luggage that either had sort of small wheels and tipped over, didn't have any wheels at all. And we had no idea what an inane thing this was. We all had a crack at this problem. Everyone suffered. Everyone went through it. You can't say that you were immune. And along comes Robert Plath. And he's a pilot, and he's irritated. And he goes to Asia, where it's cheap to get things made. And he takes things that don't have, there's no 2.0 or 3.0 or anything to tack on at the end of it. He takes some wheels. He enlarges them a little bit. He puts a telescoping handle, whatever. And he forms the rollerboard. What happens in the 1990s is that no matter when you bought your luggage in the 1980s, you rebuy your luggage immediately. The luggage industry has never seen anything like this. And I went to go visit a guy who sold my family luggage in Los Angeles. And I asked him this question. I said, can you tell me what it was that kept the industry blocked from seeing suddenly, the only time in my life I've actually literally been grabbed by the lapels. The guy looks into my eyes, he says, you don't think I think about this every night. So it's very important that we stop referring to this kind of behavior as genius. Right? Genius is what we, when we are acting in this groupthink mode, have to call the person who breaks this in order to sort of rescue our self-respect. Right? This is not really genius in the standard sense, and I think that it's important to develop a better model. We are doing ourselves no favor by hiding under that rubric. So what can we learn from Plath? First of all, the potential scope for groupthink is nearly beyond human comprehension. I think about this example, I still can't quite get it through my head, that the entire planet went through it together. Next, we must cross adaptive valleys. Rolling unstable wheeled luggage was worse. Right? Tiny little wheels. And I remember, you know, carrying these things with wheels or like, you know, carrying them and watching them list. And the fact is that those ideas were had, I guess, in the early 70s. Groupthink is also a tremendous source of opportunity if we do it right. If we don't do it right, we're in danger at some level of putting people in conflict with communities that are going to review them. And if the community is sufficiently hostile, we are cheating ourselves of a move towards the efficient frontier. So when groupthink is in play, direct, ungated market access is much more essential than it would otherwise be. And that's one of the problems with a system that works well when groupthink isn't largely at play, and there are plenty of times when it isn't. But I think it's a really interesting exercise, if you've ever been peer-reviewed and you thought that it was a little bit less than fair, to take some of the choice phrases that, you know, stick in your craw and see whether or not you can come up with a content-free review of the proposal for the roller board as opposed to the instantiation of the roller board. The last point that I want to make, and this is an oddity of science that I really don't get, is that there's this passion for talking about intelligence and ability in univariate terms. This is the second best student I've had and such, and he's the top of the field and all of this stuff. And the key point is that the difference between two variables and n is much smaller than the difference between one and two. For mathematical reasons we can talk about, but it's very important to move off of this concept that univariate intelligence works, and because what this does is it subordinates Witten to Plath, right? So if you think that at some level that Ed Witten missed this and that Robert Plath got it, you know, you can do that. But much more likely there are different attributes of intelligence that need to be looked at in a portfolio context. Next question is, what special risks does our system of peer evaluation pose for research? So I found this quote of Schwinger, which I think is very interesting. We always talk about the young people, the way other people say, what about the children? Paralyzes the mind, right? So in science, we always say, well, what are we doing to encourage the young people? Do you know how many successful older academicians sit around carping about the establishment? And you're trying to say, well, you're the man, but it's not true. People feel tremendous pressure throughout their entire career when they think they're doing something innovative. And the key problem is we allow people to block recognition rather than shorting ideas. So the question is, if you have the concept of a complete market is a market in which any view that you hold has an efficient expression, that the probable distribution of returns, you can slice and dice based on the instruments available to you so that you can get access to only the part of the distribution which you feel is mispriced. Now, what happens if you start taking away those instruments? The government says, well, we can't allow people to short themselves because the worst that happens if you go long a stock is you lose all your money. But if you short, well, it's potentially unbounded. Okay, we're going to take that away from people. And we're not going to let people buy options because it's very easy to bankrupt yourself with options. Suddenly, people are hemmed in. They can't express themselves properly in a market. Same thing is happening, I think, in scientific research. What we're seeing is reputational attacks in place of shorting behavior, which in some sense is very similar to what goes on with microcredit. So you have this whole thing happening with Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank, where it was found that you don't have to put up financial collateral. You can loan money to a group of people, preferably women, and try to use social collateral as the disincentive for defaulting on a loan. So very often, what Lee's talking about is he's saying, I really want everybody to pony up, you know, a last name or a last name they're willing to stick to, right? And I want them to take the pain. I want them to have an account, and I want it to cost them when they say really stupid, offensive things. Well, I don't know that I want that. What I really want is I want a place in which you can confine people to interacting with each other financially, not necessarily on the reputational proxy, and see if that's more efficient. You were saying, Paul.
But it's true. So it's important to mention the context of Schwinger's comment up there. He didn't say it in 1965. He said it somewhat after his Nobel Prize in the late 1980s, when he submitted a completely ludicrous and embarrassing explanation of cold fusion to FISREV Letters, which did its best to save his reputation by rejecting it.
Right, I'm trying to reject that entire framework, right? Which is, the man was gambling with his own name. I actually think that the damage to his reputation would have been exaggerated, would have been acute when it happened. But over the long haul,
he's dead.
No. When I talk about the immortality market, I'm really quite serious that people care about what they leave, anything passable. So it's illogical to say he's dead if the whole reason that we're here is selection to begin with, and we care about things
at approximate level that go beyond us. But it should be a but in the financial markets, village idiocy can be used as a funding source. Right? Maybe the problem is not enough well-heeled village idiots. Sometimes it takes a village idiot. And we all take turns saying stupid things, although some are more consistent and therefore will provide more funding to the community if this can be made to work. Certainly in the financial markets, there are large numbers of people who provide alpha to more sane investors. And the key point is trying to get an efficient outcome. I don't have any problem with letting Schwinger put his quantum electrodynamics stuff to the test and deciding he wants to diversify with a really long ball bet on cold fusion. That's fine. So first of all, the title of the talk. I had a situation where I was told to go over to the physics department at Harvard, and I was trying to understand some issue about how, before string theory, if you look, 1983 Shelter Island Conference, you see much the same thing that was said about string theory being said about supergravity. It's the same leading candidate, it's too beautiful to be wrong, blah, blah, blah. But there was this problem, aside from divergences, that the algebraic space just wasn't sufficient to accommodate the groups that we saw. And so I looked at this description that Gell-Mann had, where he was trying to force some way of seeing a 56-dimensional representation as making contact with the observed fermion generations. And there obviously wasn't room. So there was one stupid thing that I thought of, which is spin 8 is unusual in that it is a topological product, which is also true for spin 4, but it's not generally true for spin n. And if spin 7 were broken to G2, then the S7 factor would acquire, after a while, an H-space structure from triality. And I discussed this with Sidney Coleman. Sidney Coleman said, you should go talk to Sheldon. And I showed fear, and I think it was visible in my face. And he said, huh? He said, oh, you're a math guy. It's the Nobel thing, isn't it? I said, yeah. He said, well, you're comfortable talking to me, and you're not comfortable talking to him? Get out of here. So he kicked me out, which was a really nice thing to do. And it was the right thing. So I went into Sheldon's office, and I said, I want to talk to you about this group theoretics. And he says, well, wouldn't you rather solve this scattering problem in an elliptical context? I forget what it was. I said, no, I don't have any interest in that. I just want to ask you this question. So he says, all right. I went to the board, and I start sketching this out. And I say, okay, so you have this chain. You're trying to save this theory. If you break down to G2 from spin 7, he says, yeah. I said, you know, then you have S7. It picks up the structure. You've got S3 that sits inside of S7. And when you break G2 to SU3, you liberate a further U1 subgroup. He says, stop right there. He says, that's where your theory is wrong. I said, I'm not saying it's a theory. Your theory is wrong because G2 does not contain SU3. He says, if it did, that would be the most interesting thing. He said, you know, that would be much more interesting than everything else you're saying, but absolutely doesn't contain SU3. I said, really? And I thought to myself, no, of course it does. Of course it does. The quotient is the sixth sphere with its almost complex structure. So this Fakakta idea was not what we bet on. It was the containment of SU3 inside of the group G2. And the reason we bet is that we started getting into this idiotic argument. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. It wouldn't stop. So finally, I said, listen, you're a physicist. We're supposed to bet on this stuff. He says, what do you want to bet? I said, bet me anything. There was silence. He says, I bet you a dollar. What? I've been collecting for 17 years. He sold me this story, and I've been dining out. So he disagreed that G2 could not possibly contain SU3. Now, obviously, it wasn't that he was insolvent. He's a Nobel Prize-winning science. He's at the core. He's, I think, kind of a remarkable guy. I have very high regard for him. But this demarcation theory predicts the wrong answer. I did not experience what the financial types would call a liquidity event, which is what I would have expected from the wonderful rhetoric and the beliefs we have about the structure of our community. Instead, I got a different lesson in finance. I experienced a credit event because I had not properly hedged my counterparty risk, something I had not thought to do. What is the utility of the story and the utility of the wager? Well, at an earlier stage in the wager, right, before we get to the point where he throws me out of his office saying, no dollar for you, remember this was before Seinfeld, the trivial size of the bet did not reflect my preferences, it reflected his preferences. So you have two unequal individuals meeting on an intellectual point, and all you know is that one of them is willing to bet an unbounded sum, and the other was eager to limit it at $1. That information would not have been available in the absence of at least a stated transaction. So the incompleteness problem in the financial markets, I would buy a credit default swap to hedge my Glashow risk. And I would do that with some group that I felt was more credit worthy, which itself is a credit risk, but I could move my credit risk around from Sheldon to someone else. So the question is, what does one do in science? And the reason, to answer Jacques' question, that I didn't collect, because I thought it would be kind of nifty to get a dollar bill signed by somebody who's going to go into the history books in perpetuity, I never figured out how I would collect. And I couldn't solve that problem. And so in large measure, the question is, well, what do you do when you reach an incompleteness? You fall off the edge of the academic marketplace of ideas. And I suppose because I'm no longer worried about funding and feeding myself from this world, I'm pretty comfortable giving this talk because it's a true story. Paul.
To be honest, Chuck, Kerry Collins did know that G2 contains SU3. I checked with him, and moreover, he knew that your theory in your terminology was farfakta because G2 has only real representations.
Right. Scientists again.
Well, I wasn't trying to put forward. I keep having this conversation, and I feel like it's Garrett's conversation that I've somehow inherited. But. Pardon me?
His group.
But the issue is contained because Gelman's scheme wouldn't have worked to make the identification with the 48 sitting inside of the 56 either. But Murray. But he's never come out the other side of that. So example 2A. Attempts to hedge peer review risk. What happens when you submit your paper to a journal? So can we bring Harry back into this discussion? So the claim was that somebody had submitted a paper to a journal, and how many people had read that paper?
Three.
He claimed three. Who were the three?
His mom.
He said
Harry. The author and the reviewer? Do I have that right?
And the editor, not the reviewer.
And the editor, not the reviewer. So I claim that that might be an upper bound. But try to see what's wrong with the following proof. This was published in 1993 in the Journal of Differential Geometry, which carried Donaldson's work and proofs of exotic R4s, very respectable journal. And as you can see, this is very carefully checked. Because in math, in math, unlike in experimental science, we don't have to wait for the data. We have an objective standard. And the referees are diligent, and we form an expert community.
What's the footnote?
You guys are like the best pipe laying audience I've ever seen. The footnote. Example 2B continued. What is Mike's dog and what is hedging single advisor risk? Well, Mike is Michael David Grossberg, who's a math PhD at MIT. And Mike was having some difficulty getting through his thesis. And at some point, he became suspicious that his advisor was not reading what he was submitting, but just asking for a rewrite every week. And Mike became very frustrated that no matter what he did, he could not get the text to have that kind of, I mean, his advisor is a master expositor, and to have that kind of tight quality which really explained what the deep idea behind it was. So Mike became terrified and exasperated. I watched this psychological meltdown. And finally, he devolved into rhyming. So he wrote, "If and only if my dog ate a frog on a log in the bog." And in the heart of the argument, he put this, and then he closed with, "Raoul, are you even reading this?" Same interaction at the end of the week. "Well, I think it's an improvement, but we could do better." So when no comment was made, Mike learned something. He had scattered nonsense off of this review process, and you know, he caught what came off the target, and he stopped wasting his time. And he started understanding that what he was interpreting as professional feedback of the highest order was actually catching a very busy person who had a lot of things to do. And you know, his work had probably been improved by rewriting and rewriting it, but it wasn't responsive to what he was doing. So you guys are on the web, right? Everybody can do this instantaneously. So this is the end of 15 years. As of 9/2008, if you put in "Mike's dog really," you got exactly one hit on Google. How sweet it is. Hasta la vista, baby. So it did garner 22 citations from a Fields medalist and from NAS members. So what I want to do is I want to back us up a little bit to the enthusiasm about looking at citations and these great data sets and what they mean and whether you can use citations as a proxy for contribution or for recognition.
Back to your office or wherever, you look up in the classic condensed matter theory text, Ashcroft and Merman, the word prose in the index.
Okay.
Exercise for everyone here.
All right.
Could you be less cryptic on that?
Yeah, why don't you enjoy the exercise?
Because I'm a sociologist and you never get a good article.
You want to spell Ashcroft and Merman?
Okay.
I mean, it's in the library. It's classic text.
So
still used.
So I'm being flipped, but the point that I've learned from The Economist, which took me a while to understand, is that they used to ask important questions, and they still want to ask important questions, but they've understood the utility of getting a completely clean event. And instead of starting with what I want to know, you can say, where do I have a clean event where I might learn something? And so hopefully, there was enough cleanliness in that to at least begin a conversation as to whether all of this talk about, I mean, it's very hard at some level, from my intellectual perspective, to hear people talking about content and citations as if this is some sort of electronic adventure as opposed to the reason that we write these papers to begin with. So what I want to get to is things that might be more serious and less fun. So one that I'm aware of, because I was around for the prediction, was an evolutionary theory which claimed that cancer was not a disease, it was intrinsically part of a trade-off in terms of what's called antagonistic pleiotropy, and that non-coding regions of DNA like telomeres on the end of the chromosomes would elongate and shrink and mutate much more rapidly than coding regions, and that the breeding protocol used for laboratory mice would be expected to elongate telomeres, thereby rendering the laboratory version of the mouse much less relevant than the wild type version of the mouse simply by virtue of the control in the breeding protocol. This was tested, and the result was found that the telomeres were clearly elongated, although we couldn't tell that it was from the breeding protocol, but it was a striking positive result. But because the evolutionists didn't own the lab and the bench and the place to do the experiment, they were dependent on the molecular biologist who viewed this as an interesting conversation but hardly worthy of formal recognition. So the question is, what is the optimal hedging instrument in that situation? Is the market complete enough that an evolutionary biologist can approach a colleague and without entering into some complicated NDA agreement, attempt to ensure that recognition will be delivered when there isn't a strong incentive structure to keep the person in one field from slighting the person in the other? And what is lost to us is any possible implications for drug safety that might come out of the larger theory rather than the individual prediction. So that didn't involve me. So this is one that did involve me. So in the mid-1990s, there was a desire to fix the third rail of American politics. What was the third rail? The third rail was the entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And how do we get a lower payout and at the same time raise taxes and do it without paying a political cost? Well, turns out that there's a logical thing to do, which is to look at the fact that tax brackets are indexed to inflation. So the higher inflation is stated to be, the less you have to pay in taxes. And benefits also go in the same direction. So if you could find any reason to lower the stated rate of inflation, you could accomplish both of these goals. And since these programs are so large, even a small restatement of the rate of inflation would cause massive transfers of wealth. So the argument was advanced by the Boskin Commission that the only way to do this is to understand that America has a dynamic economy, and in that dynamic economy, you cannot take a fixed basket of goods that was relevant in one year and presume that it should be priced in another year. That made a certain amount of sense. I liked it. What about preferences? What they used was chicken and beef as an example, and they said, prices change, and we compensate you for the amount of chicken and beef that you once bought, right? And the price of beef goes up, you'll just shift to chicken, and then you'll pocket the difference, whatever we compensate you in terms of your Social Security payment, and you'll spend it on something else, and that's not fair, because you'll be getting more utility. Well, is that the only reason people switch from beef to chicken? No, health reasons. I mean, there's documented evidence that you can look at people's preferences, and they've changed, particularly Great Britain's done a good job in documenting this. Well, the one thing that never changes in economics, almost, is human preference. Whatever preference you're expected to have, it stays fixed and it's encoded, and this is a talk I gave the last time I was here, as a codimension one foliation where the leaves are convex to the origin and complete in the positive orthant. And it's very easy to talk about dynamic foliations. There's no problem in modeling it. The problem is that there's no interpretation to how to keep somebody on their indifferent surfaces as things change. And for that, you need gauge theory of function spaces. And it's a beautiful application. What you see is kind of interesting here. Traditional neoclassical economics has worked with the assumption that preferences of agents in the economy are fixed. In the social sciences outside of neoclassical economics, the assumption has never been accepted by anyone. This is much more interesting than some of the examples that we've seen recently in physics, because it's much more obvious. Nobody can claim that preferences are fixed. It doesn't even make sense economically that people would spend on advertising is education. No, it's a belief in the field that is necessary to participate in the mainstream of ideas. And this is part of the problem, which is what most of us want is not citation, but we want to make contact with that main narrative. So, curiosity, this is the physicist von Weizsäcker's son. And what you see at the bottom is that he's really, I mean, in prose, trying to reinvent Weyl's theory of gauge, right? The original theory from like 1919. Now, we have what I call the global village idiot co-cycle problem. So in this system, there were a very small number of players. Oh, it's because I'm protecting Erwin DeWert, a Canadian. A very fine economist at the University of British Columbia. Sorry about that. So the idea is that the Boston Commission said, you know, the way we're going to do this is we're going to use superlative index theory, developed by DeWert, who's led the charge in this area. We went to DeWert and we said, how do you do this stuff with changing preferences? He says, oh, you guys need to talk to the holy of holies, Bert Balk, who works in the Netherlands. He is the index theorist, and he's the only guy with the mathematical know-how to evaluate your work. Bert was totally nice, and he gave us about the only citation we got. The Boston Commission has two arrows that I hope are the same. I'm colorblind. Did I get that right? So what they did was they said, you guys are complete idiots. There's nothing to your theory. It's nothing we haven't seen before, and even if we had, it's wrong, and don't even bother us. I thought of it first. So, yeah. Which is very much the way patents are done, right? We claim this huge thing, and if that's not true, then we claim something slightly less grand. It's the get smart theory of the invention. So what you have is you have an inability to find who is majorizing everybody else. We are, in some sense, all subordinated. And you have this real level of indecision, which is one of the reasons I got frustrated with the idea that this question of who's in and who's out is no problem for expert communities. It's a problem for expert communities, and a lot of times it isn't, but even knowing where it's a problem, where it isn't, you know, good people can disagree. Next one I want to give was something, so another person to blame for this talk would be David Kaiser, because he called me up in my office and he said, you're not going to give your talk on scientific manpower theory, are you? So I could take a hint. But 2 points came up in that talk. One was that we should be careful about shortages, which I objected to. No, we should not be careful about shortages. Let me explain manpower shortages succinctly in a market economy as opposed to a Soviet planned economy. Market economies don't really have labor shortages. That's why we have the wage mechanism, right? Market's clear. You can have temporary dislocations. But anytime somebody tells you that they're looking at a market shortage of scientists and engineers, they are announcing to you, I am either seeking rent or I have no idea what I'm talking about. Right? The issue of barriers inside of a market, I'm claiming that that is not what I mean by a market economy. The licensed, right, is the problem.
Would you agree that there is a market shortage?
I do not agree that there is a market shortage of competent plumbers that I need to worry about.
Well, that depends on how much you're willing to pay to get your tap fixed.
Well, guys, I'm really glad this came up because I'm having a Steinway shortage in my apartment. And if you've ever heard the one about the two famous economists who past the Porsche dealership, and the first economist looks through the window and he's just, can't take it. Oh, I love that car. And the other one says, no, you don't. Okay, reveal preference, Joe. They're passing the Porsche dealership. Yeah, sorry. The key point is that we don't have labor shortages. You may disagree with the wage mechanism. You may say that there are artificially created labor shortages. But the fact of the matter is that what the National Science Foundation and the National Academy of Sciences are trying to do is very often study the burden on employers. And they would like to decrease the burden on employers. You know, Alan Greenspan, well, you can't say the problem is wages are going up. You have to say, you know, we are suffering from inflated wage pressure. Somehow that clouds the mind. This study was not supposed to exist, right? So the key point was this was done in 1986. There are the series of studies that come after it, which do this demographic analysis. And the claim of the economists is, oh, you know, the big problem is that they didn't look at the wage mechanism. They didn't look at the elasticities of supply and demand.
Yes, they did. Right? This was done by Miles Boylan, although he didn't put his name on it. And he looked at the elasticities, and he came up with a projection that new PhDs would be earning in excess of six figures after the year 2000. And this was seen as a pessimistic scenario. Would that depress, you know, you guys, if new PhDs all got six figures? Is that pessimistic? I don't know. The question is, you've got to understand what people are trying to accomplish. So the last one I want to give, this is really a painful one, as I was sitting in my office at 4 a.m. and the phone rings, and as is usually the case, it's somebody calling from London. And they said, Dr. Weinstein. I said, yeah. And he said, we wanted to know if you'd like to write a book. I said, on what? And they said, on the issue of the subprime mortgage crisis. And I said, why would I do that? And they said, well, you're the only paper we can find that analytically tries to price mortgage-backed securities in an acceptable scheme. Well, that was a little bit flattering, but the real brains at some level for looking at this question was Adil Abdullahi. And he wasn't going to bother with, he was a mathematician at MIT. The fact is that he had the right idea. Go to the market and short. And he came to me before this whole thing blew up, and he said, here's what's about to unfold. And he spelled the whole thing out as clearly as I can, you know, can understand. He more or less understood that there was going to be collapse of this wave function that we'd used to define these phantom prices, because there was going to be price discovery because somebody was introducing an investable index, right? So after you have this collapse of this wave function, the whole market was going to react. And he did, and his company did very, very nicely. So the key point is, you have ideas about how to price these sorts of things. They occur in the literature. Sometimes they occur on the web. There is expertise in the community. But the key point is that disruptive knowledge is not treated the same way as knowledge that builds within the framework, right? And that's what you, I think, you understand over and over again. The key question is, was this disruptive before? Absolutely. After you have a demise like Bear Stearns or Fannie and Freddie, which I still can't imagine, the idea is that this is no longer disruptive thinking. This is commonplace thinking. So the key question is how to invite disruptive thinking back into the system. We had it before, but we glutted ourselves in order to decrease wages. And that had an effect. So what I want, so my aim in all of this is to think about what it is that we would do to build a black swan hatchery. And think about what it is we can learn from history and whether it's a worthwhile endeavor. I think it could be done relatively cheaply in a few fields: evolutionary biology, mathematics, theoretical physics, and economics. It's very, very cheap to supply people. You don't really need much more than chalk and coffee and salaries. And I really think that the right way to go is not to use the federal governments as funders. You want to use high net worth individuals and sell them some of your surplus immortality. So the first thing I want to attack in this is I want to stop thinking about the solitary genius, because it's a very romantic model. I think that a lot of people who pull these things off are not necessarily geniuses in the standard sense. And they're people who usually get organizations around them fairly quickly. But because the N is sufficiently small, we probably have to abstract across disciplines. Now, I'm sure a historian of science could do this much better. But there are a few roles that come about that I see as kind of concerned, although they don't occur forever. In general, there needs to be a funding source with pockets. There needs to be a protector or a backer who recognizes talent early and is capable of identifying that even when other people would look to reputational issues to try to figure out where the person is. There's sometimes someone who's needed to do the outreach because the person who developed this doesn't understand what the conceptual difficulty is in explaining it to others. And very occasionally, you need a Starker. So a Starker is somebody who hopefully is high up in the field and is not afraid to make the frightening phone call when somebody is found as a detractor who needs to explain themselves fully and kind of put up or shut up. Now, if we had a functioning marketplace, you could probably do without the Starker, right? As long as you had a funder, you could afford take positions with people who are negatively disposed towards you, and you could just deal with it from the perspective of trying to bankrupt them rather than trying to push them aside. However, the older concept is worth thinking about, and there's some history to it. I think that it's really only relevant to people who are perceived as being highly, highly disruptive. So it's a little bit of an exotic. The last thing I want to get to is what I call the flamingo meritocracy. So one of the problems that I have is that there is a perspective in the academy, which is much less than it used to be, but it's still there, in which people claim, and we went and we interviewed some of the top molecular and cellular biologists in the country for the ASCB, American Society for Cell Biology. And it was very interesting the way they polarized. Some of them felt that the job market was absolutely terrific. The pressure was great. It weeded out anybody who didn't belong for the love of science, and that you should expect to devote 75 hours a week, defer fertility, if you really have that kind of deep love of your field. And other people said, this is crazy. We've gone out of control. We lost these thoughtful types, particularly those who came from physics, who did great work by thinking. And we've turned this into a competition to see who can publish incrementally earlier. And this has become much more of an entrepreneurial business situation rather than a scientific one. So at some point in listening to these people, I started thinking about what models they had in their mind for what happens when things get pressurized and funding gets tight. And so I came up with a bunch of, I started thinking about Sewell Wright's theory of adaptive landscapes. And the idea, what happens when you have a univariate problem versus a multivariate problem where you have different attributes, what economists would call hedonics. So if you have really only one dimension in which ability is located, it's very clear that it's sad when things get pressurized, but you don't effectively lose the top people, you just lose the bottom part of the curve. And it's not, you know, it's sad, but it's not a tragedy for the subject. I thought more interesting was the situation that you see in East Africa, which I've never seen it written up. But there's this funny thing where the lakes, the soda lakes, have these different pHs. And as the alkalinity increases, you start seeing different diversity patterns. And when you get to the most alkaline lake, which I think is like pH 11, what you get is flamingos. And it's the only place the lesser flamingos nest in East Africa. And why do they nest there? Because everything else dissolves going in, waiting in, trying to get them. And they have adapted as extremophiles to be able to survive. So the question at some level is what happens when you turn up the pressure? This also goes to the dispute about whether the Harvard Physics Department was cuddly and friendly or full of mean people. Is it has to do with what your natural immunities are. So here you have a shifting, simple oscillating alkalinity situation. You allow these characteristics of the various birds in this laboratory lake you create to remain fixed. And you watch what happens as the indifference curves, which represent fitness levels here, move around. And the key point is that you find lots of systems that when you start selecting on an immunity rather than an ability, start to produce one type of individual or a small number of types of individuals in large numbers. Right? So one of the puzzles that Larry Summers set for us before he was asked to leave was, what is it that's keeping women out of science in some of these fields? And I think he had three hypotheses. Either it's discrimination, which he thought was unlikely because Gary Becker had made the proposal that if it was, you could hire women cheaply and outcompete other departments that had the problem of discriminating. It could be childbearing, or it could be some sort of natural endowment, right? Well, I didn't accept the idea that it could only be one of these three things. What if it's an immunity problem? And the idea is that most men don't have the immunities to hang out in these highly competitive fields.
And most women don't either. But the few people who do have the immunities rather than the abilities are much more likely to be male than female. That would neatly fit, I think, all of the possibilities. So if you view this as a problem of extremophiles, you could easily end up selecting on an immunity. So for example, in basketball, the high height of the basket is a disease, and height is the immunity. And you have a flamingo meritocracy where somebody like Michael Jordan, who, I don't know what he was, he's 6'6", is considered relative, what? 6'6"? You know, is considered somebody of relatively modest stature, right? I know very few people who are 6'6". And I've tried to avoid meeting Chad because I want to be able to continue to say this in the future. But it's worth thinking about what happens in fields like boxing versus basketball, where in one case you have a flamingo meritocracy, in another case, weight classes allow people of all different abilities to interact. And I think that's kind of an important part of this puzzle. Let me see if I have anything left, and I'll wrap up even if I do. Oh, one general good idea. I had hoped to talk about various financial instruments needed to complete these markets. But one idea that I really like is the idea that we need to get tenure to people much, much earlier in their career when it makes a difference. And we're not going to be able to do that within the system as we know it. So what we could do is instead find a small number of individuals with some help from high net worth individuals, and sorry, small number of investigators with help from high net worths, and try to come up with some program where they are encouraged to take risks, and if it doesn't work out, they're provided some sort of an honorable exit to an attractive life, which many people, I find, young people, worry about. Because if I leave this world, am I going to go down to the bottom of some other world? Am I going to be stuck wearing a suit and you know, getting coffee for somebody else? People don't have any idea what was going to happen. If you had a guaranteed idea that you were going to end up someplace that was acceptable to you, might you be willing to take those risks early on in your career? I think I'll stop there. Thank you for your time. And if anybody has any questions, I'd love to talk about financial instruments to complete markets.